You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Jeffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Jeffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you so much for listening. It's a wonderful treat to have so many nice people out there who send us such excellent messages. And I've got some more people to read out.
Oh, yeah, we've got some new Patreon members.
Oh, well done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It really does help us keep all this show on the road.
Keep the show and just about on the road.
Yes, as much as we've ever been on the road.
Roadworthy, here we go.
Okay, I'm going to read them out. Oh, lovely. We've got, well, these are our new Patreon members. William Sebold, William Rees, Kit Sin, Stephanie Roach, Katie Rose, Emma Heathcott, and Sean Parry.
Sean Parry.
I'm sorry.
It's S-I-A-N, isn't it?
It's Sean.
Sean, I'm so sorry. Sean is a long-time listener. She writes me quite a lot. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sean. Sorry to get your name wrong.
It's all right. We've corrected it now.
Molly's, as ever, practical approach.
You know me.
I do. Well, what a week.
I'm so practical. I sometimes think like I'm in such a kind of, I get this from you, but I live in such a specific routine and I do everything in a certain way.
I'm afraid
now because I'm not drinking. So I'm like,
yeah,
I do get it from you.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, I am a terrible creature of habit.
But it's like, oh, it's getting worse, I think. It's going to become impossible to live with me or anything with me soon.
I find it difficult to live with myself, actually. Sometimes, anyway.
Especially at the minute.
Yes, these are long days.
I have been doing yoga every morning.
Oh, that's good. That's excellent.
Yeah, I have an online teacher called Jared.
Is that still going on?
South Africa. Yeah.
Oh, well done.
Me and my client Miles do yoga every morning at 7.
You online. And Miles. That's enough to make me laugh right there.
Well, you know, we turn up and that's what it's about.
Ah, that's what it is about.
I'm not very good, but it's the effort that counts, isn't it?
It's always the effort that counts, Mo. Always. Well, what have I done? Oh, yes. Well, this week has seen the publication of Dennis Nielsen's autobiography.
Oh, my word.
The History of the Drowning Man. A Drowning Boy, I beg your pardon.
Wow.
It was part serialised in the Sunday Times last week, and I got my copy in the post this week.
We might be a week out. Are we a week out? This is being released.
Well, it doesn't
Well,
matter.
You know what we mean, listeners.
Yes.
The History of a Drowning Boy, Dennis Nielsen. And so is this taken from his writings in the...
Yes.
That they found in...
Yes.
The prison.
The writings that were given to Mark Austin.
And here's a lot of pictures of his archive as well.
Yes.
There's glasses and things.
There's a very touching note in the front, darling.
Oh. Well, I hope he's pleased.
I think he is.
That was his...
Didn't get universal praise, I'm afraid.
Well, it's a bit of a tricky subject, isn't it? Let's face it.
I'm not in the doubters camp. I think if there's an appetite out there, people should be allowed to read Nielsen's words. I actually think Nielsen personally think that Nielsen was nothing short of a monster, and no amount of whitewash is ever going to change that. But that's not the same point. The point is that he did take a great deal of trouble to say what he thought he meant and what he was doing and explaining his actions.
Mm.
I doubt he really does, actually, but never mind.
Mm.
It's pretty. It's an awful lot of philosophy, an awful lot of rambling on.
Well, I mean, he wrote like 70,000
6 million words.
6 million words. That book is not.
No. That's a.
He had to condense it down a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
he really had a lot to say for himself, didn't he? But I suppose if you're in prison all that time and you like writing, maybe that.
Yeah.
The thing to do.
No, so that's the sort of one thing that's happened this week.
Other than that, the weeks just generally sort of are the same, aren't they?
They are pretty much, aren't they? But on the other hand, it's just a question of getting through to the spring.
It's getting lighter and staying lighter longer.
That's a good thing.
I know that because when I do my yoga, when I first started on the 4th of January, it was still dark when I finished at 8 and now it isn't anymore.
No, absolutely. I'm very aware of it because I always keep the shutters open. So I know very well that it's getting slightly lighter. Mm. And I'm very much driven by that. When I go to, I do my supermarket shopping now on a Friday morning, very early. And I get there when the shop opens at 7, and I come back. And I used to come back in the dark, but now I'm coming back in the almost light.
There you go, you see. So, something positive.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you regular listeners will be aware that we've had a slight disagreement over our opinions on The Serpent, the BBC drama, which will be coming onto Netflix soon, but is now available for all of you that live in the UK on iPlayer. It will come on Netflix. I'm not entirely sure when, but eventually you'll be able to see it. Jeffrey wasn't a huge fan at the beginning. It's quite tricky to get into because it jumps around a lot in time and stuff, and it's a bit befuddling at first. I found the first couple of eps a bit tricky, but it's a compelling story and it's going down well.
Yes.
In the industry, a lot of you have written to me to say, please, can you get Jeffrey to change his mind? So,
oh no, I'm
not change his mind about whether he likes it, but we are going to cover it.
We are, and I think that's important that we should. I think I've watched all 8 episodes. And I agree with Mo that it gets better. I think it takes a bit of getting into.
Yeah, it's a bit long, probably 8 episodes. I mean, it obviously was just, it's such a rambling, long story. We're having to do 2 episodes for it.
To cover it, yes.
So obviously it's a lot, but it's still 8 episodes is also a lot, I guess. So.
Yes, 8 hours is a long sit.
Mm.
But yes, I think some of the performances are excellent. And I think the man who plays Subraj.
I love Tahar Rahim.
Tahar Rahim?
He can do no wrong in my eyes.
Tahara.
Tahar Rahim, he broke out in this French movie called The Prophet. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
It's on Netflix. You might quite like it. He's a kind of young criminal who gets put in prison and he gets tied into a gang and it's like about him being pushed back and forth by this gang.
Uh-huh.
It's really good.
Okay.
Very good piece of French cinema. And yeah, so he's one thing amazing in it.
I wanted to watch is the new series of Call My Agent.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's so exciting that's out. I'm going to watch that.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
I was nearly going to watch it last night, but then I wanted to finish off The Night Stalker, so I did that instead.
Mm.
So Call My Agent, which I loved the first 3 series
Me
of.
Too.
Absolutely beautiful. Very good. And this fourth one's got Sigourney Weaver in it.
Call My Agent is good for you all to watch, listeners, because that's what I do on a day-to-day basis.
Yes.
It's a little bit different because it's French, but the basic tenets are what I do on my day-to-day life.
Yes, that's what
If you'd like to know what I do versus what Jeffrey does.
Yes.
We've gabbered on for ages.
Shall we go?
So we'll get on with it. So I suppose we are calling it The Serpent, are we?
We must call it The Serpent.
So here we go with The Serpent Part 1.
Charles Subraj, also known as The Serpent, and in some quarters as the Bikini Killer, was born on the 6th of April 1944. He's mother was a Vietnamese shop girl, and his father was a fairly successful Indian businessman in Saigon, Vietnam, which is now known as Ho Chi Minh City. His father was a tailor. He had a tailoring business. The parents didn't stay together, and the father and mother split. Mother then formed a new relationship with a French army lieutenant who didn't much care for her son with the Indian businessman, because they went on to have another family.
Mm-hmm.
And Subraj was the eldest, but of course wasn't the French army lieutenant's own child. So there was a certain
outsiderish
disconnect, a sort of outsiderishness in it from the very beginning. Subraj was shuttled about a bit between Saigon and Indochina and France, and he had some difficulties because when the family went to France, he couldn't speak French and felt even more of an outsider.
Yeah, of course.
So he really didn't fit in, the square peg and the round hole. But he did become, as a teenager, interested in petty crime. It's a very familiar pattern, isn't it? We've talked about it many times. There was a little history of petty crimes, a bit of burglary. And in 1963, when he was 19, he gets sent to jail for the first time for burglary. After his release, this is Obrage's release, he has a very much longer name if you look him up, with three Vietnamese words before Charles Sobhraj, but I'm going to stick to calling him Charles Sobhraj because it gets very, very complicated.
Yeah, because he keeps changing his name.
Well, he does change his name quite a lot, but let's get on to that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, shortly after his release from prison in 64, when he was about 20, he meets and begins a passionate affair with a woman called Chantai Compagnon. And indeed, he proposed to her. And on the very day he proposed, he was arrested for driving a stolen car and sent to jail. But she stood by, remained loyal, and 8 months later, they married on his release from jail. He was then, and as the story unfolds, becomes increasingly clear, he was incredibly charismatic. He was narcissistic, sure, but my goodness me, the charisma was palpable. He was rather romantic in a way, a bit swashbuckling. He liked to run on the edge of the law. There was an awful lot of stealing cars and driving fences and perhaps now and again a tiny bit of drug dealing. But nothing, you know, that was to foreshadow what was to come. In 1970... The married pair, left France for Asia, mostly because they wanted to escape him being arrested again. And so he's using false papers and she's pregnant. They arrive in Mumbai and have a baby girl called Usha. But Sobhraj doesn't really change his ways, so he goes back to car theft and a bit of smuggling, because along the way, he's developed an addiction to gambling. So you have this passionate, charismatic, attractive psychopath. He has no conscience. He has no... only regard is for himself. And in 1973... he's arrested after a failed armed robbery attempt at a jewellery store. And now begins another part of the...
In Mumbai.
Yeah. Now begins another part of what was to become his fingerprints. He escapes. He feigns illness. Is sent to the hospital where he's... well, how can I? It sets fire to a van. It's a long and complicated story, but it's very Sobhraj. He's always pretending to be something, and in this case, pretending to be ill. He fakes illness. He escapes. He's very much Subrage's handwriting. He always liked to pretend. So there would be the pretense of illness, the pretense of, I must go to hospital. He was a con man as well, which in a way fits in with his personality. So now he's fled to
Kabul.
Still with his wife, okay? So this time they start robbing tourists on what was then known as the Hippie Trail. So perhaps we should just do a little paragraph here about the Hippie Trail.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 60s and the early 70s, it was a great habit of young people who felt disenchanted with life in a Western society to take off for Asia. You could go to Nepal, you could go to Vietnam, you could go to Thailand, you could go to... It was a way of freeing themselves from what they saw as Western constraints. Lots of people did it. In fact, a dear friend, a man I knew well, called Richard Neville, and his girlfriend Julie Clark set off on it. Richard had edited a magazine in London called Oz, which was famous for being prosecuted for obscenity in the early 70s. He was briefly jailed along with his two colleagues, but in the end was released and in fact took off. He was originally Australian. He took off across the Hippie Trail, which led from England through Europe and into Asia. He was with a girlfriend called Julie Clark, who was about 10 years younger than he was. She was in her early 20s and he was in his early 30s. This was something that you did. It gave you a sense of freedom. Nowadays, or rather in your time, Mo, they used to call it the gap year.
Yeah.
But it wasn't called a gap year then. It was something else.
Mm.
So now they're preying. Essentially, they're conning tourists out of their money and their papers. He and his wife are very engaging company, and they run a very louche, engaging, some drugs, you can do what you like. And Subrage hits on a tactic which was to become another part of his handwriting, which is to give hippies, young people, who of course are not connected with their families because they're literally thousands of miles away.
No WhatsApp,
no email.
To give them a type of drug, did he?
To give them drugs. Often drugged them and then stole from them while they were drugged.
Mm-hmm.
Often stealing their passports. He liked to have several identities. Comes out in the television that he was always stealing passports and pasting his own picture into the passport so that he had another identity. Anyway, they finally, they escape again. This time they flee to Iran. I think Shantai by this time is loyal, but...
Also, they've got a baby by now.
Indeed. And she's still with us, Usha. So she decides to go back to France and leaves Subrage, who is still basically doing the same thing, conning tourists out of their money. He spends about 2 years on the run after fleeing from Afghanistan. And he's using 10 stolen passports or possibly more. And he rounds up, believe it or not, his younger half-brother, André, one of the French lieutenant's children with his mother, in Istanbul. And they're committing crimes in Turkey and in Greece. I mean, we are talking about a peripatetic criminal here.
Yeah.
Still very charismatic, still incredibly attractive to women, still with the extraordinary ability to, how can one put it politely, to trap people. Eventually, the pair are caught in Athens. André is sent back to Turkey to face jail. But guess what? Subrage escapes again.
Mm-hmm.
André spends 18 years in a Turkish jail.
Oh my God, that's awful.
That is a long time to spend in a Turkish jail. But on the run again, this time Sobhraj is posing as a gem salesman and a part-time drug dealer to impress his tourists' catchment pool, whom he's going to steal from. I can't tell you exactly when, but at some point at this, in this era, he must have considered for the first time whether or not he should kill his prey. But before he gets to that, he meets a French girl called Marie-Andrée Leclerc.
French-Canadian.
French-Canadian. Who becomes, I suppose you could say, his first follower, true follower. Although perhaps his wife was, in a way, his first true follower. And at the same time, shortly afterwards, they're joined by a young Indian man called A.J. Chowdhury, who becomes effectively his accomplice.
It's a sort of dog's body.
Stuff. Yeah, go-to man.
Go-to person.
And Sobhraj and Chowdhury commit their first known murder, and it's important to say that, in 1975. It was an American girl called Teresa Knowlton from Seattle. Most of the murders, Sobhraj claimed, were accidents, accidental drug overdoses. Absolutely not the case, but nevertheless, that was what he pretended. That was his pretense. Anyway, poor Teresa Knowlton, who is the first known victim, is found in a tidal pool in the Gulf of Thailand wearing a flowered bikini. It was originally thought of as an accident. And it's not until months later, we are talking about Thailand in 1975, when the autopsy shows that it was in fact murder. But by this time, of course, Sobhraj has changed identity again. He's now beginning to adopt all sorts of other pseudonyms. Alain was quite a famous one.
Yeah.
Danielle is another one. It's pseudonym after pseudonym. Passport after passport. Different papers after different papers. And it's not just women he preys on. The second victim is a nomadic Sephardic Jew called Vitali Hakim, whose burnt body is found near the Pattaya resort where Sobhraj is staying. And I think it's now important to make a point that I think doesn't come out in the Serpent television, in that Sobhraj is collecting around himself what amounts to a cult, young men and women who are attracted by his lifestyle. He's very charismatic. In that respect, he bears comparison to Charles Manson.
He sort of sets up an environment for them to... He's like, come and party with me. We'll take care of everything.
We'll look after everything.
Come with us. You'll be safe here.
Yeah, come in, you know, come and share the house. You want to stay here? Fine. Yeah. You know, it's all right with us. Of course, there are some drugs. You know, it's...
That's what they're there for, aren't they?
So. Yeah, they're for, you know, having a good time.
Good time.
And they're throwing off the shackles of Western civilization and experiencing new things in beautiful countryside and in, you know, lovely weather, and it's very free and easy. It's, you can see how attractive it is. I'm not mistaking it, but it's important to remember that Sobhraj, no, he didn't go as far as Manson, but it was very similar in many ways, except Sobhraj killed himself. Manson got the others, the family, to kill for him.
Yeah, whereas he was doing the killing.
So the second victim was, believe it or not, a Sephardic Jew who just happened to be nomadic. And then come the two Dutch students, Henk Bintana, who's 29, and his fiancée, Cornelia Henke, who's 25. They were with Sobhraj in this free and easy, loose-knit community, and he poisons them, drugs them, and then brings them back to life. One of those tricks, I don't mean to make this sound easy or facile, but He gives him control over them. Look what I can do. And they are literally under his spell. I don't think there's another word for it. It's a spell. Eventually, I think they, at this point, is being known as Alain. At this point, they, I don't think they realise what danger they're in.
Mm.
In fact, I don't think many of the people who fell victim to Sobhraj realised the intense danger
or
they were
in. Or if by the time they were drugged and being taken somewhere, there's just nothing they could do.
Not really. And anyway, Sobhraj and Chowdhury kill the couple, and their bodies were found burned in December 1975. But by this point, the nomadic Sephardic Jew Vitali Hakim's girlfriend, Charmaine Carew, has turned up looking for him. Well, that is a bit of an inconvenience to Sobhraj and Chowdhury. Shortly after she arrived, she was found
dead,
quotes, drowned, wearing another flowered bikini. At this point, Sobhraj earns the nickname of the bikini killer. But of course, Sobhraj and Marie-André and Chowdhury have now gone to Nepal. The usual new passport, new identity, let's go to another Asian country nearby. And they used, believe it or not, the Dutch couple's passports to get across the border.
So, of course, then if anybody says, where's this couple, you go, oh, well, they've flown to Nepal, so
yeah.
They're not here anymore.
They're not here anymore.
But actually, they're not alive at all.
Again, we're now in a bit of a spree. It's December 1975. And Sobhraj kills two more students, Laurent Carrière from Canada, who was 26, and Connie Bronzich, who was 29, from the US. And again, the same trick. They use those passports to go back to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
But by now, one or two of the other members of the family are getting suspicious. This doesn't seem quite right. And in particular, two of the French followers alert the local authorities, the police, to what they fear might be going on and disappear back to France. But that doesn't for one moment put off Sobhraj. He goes on his own this time to Calcutta in India, where he kills Avoni Jacob. And then uses that passport to go to Singapore and then back to India. And in March 1976, he goes back to Bangkok. Even though he knows by this time that the authorities are looking for him, they arrest him. They interrogate him. But ever plausible, Sobhraj has got nothing to do with me and this is a complete mistake. And then I suppose what is the most chilling of all this part of the story, the Thai authorities, so it's said, allegedly, release him because they don't want to hurt the tourist trade, which has been helping the economy. Of the hippie trail has been helping the Thai economy considerably. And they don't want there to be a stain upon it. So back together with Marie-André and Chowdhury, they go to Malaysia. I mean, I'm sorry if this sounds ridiculous, but it literally was a kind of road trip around Southeast Asia. They go to Malaysia. Now, what happened in Malaysia is very much a matter of speculation. Chowdhury, second in command, accomplice, whatever else, is instructed by Sobhraj to steal more gems. He's partly posing as a gem dealer, partly as a drug dealer. And is he really Anna, or is he Danielle, or who is he? He's actually Charles Sobhraj, of course. And Chowdhury does steal the gems and does indeed give the gems to Sobhraj. But it's the last time he's ever seen. His body has never been found, even though it's believed, but it's never been proved, that Sobhraj did away with his accomplice. So, Sobhraj, still with Marie-André, starts again to collect another family, another set of followers. And this time he comes across a young Englishwoman called Barbara Smith and an American called Mary Ellen Ether. And he meets them in Bombay. It's extraordinary. Sobhraj kills a Frenchman called Jean-Luc Soliman during a robbery. He poisons him. So now the body count is rising. But even then, there is no limit to Sobhraj's confidence. In July 1976, he's joined by Marie-André and Barbara Smith from Hampshire. Her father ran a village post office. And Mary Ellen. And they... I mean, the sheer boldness of the man takes your breath away. He decides that he's going to... It's almost beyond belief. He decides he's going to persuade a group of French tourists who are visiting that he's a tour guide. They're engineering students from Tarbes in France. And he besides them, he's warned them of the perils of dysentery and offered to give them drugs to prevent it.
Didn't he drug all of them in one go?
Yep. The capsules...
A bit ambitious.
The capsules, according to Julie Clark, who went on to write a book about Sobhraj with Richard Neville, said he tested the pills on Barbara Smith from Hampshire. And they were really a crude mixture of sleeping pills and laxatives. But anyway, he meets the group, this group of engineering students for a tour, at the Vikram Hotel in Delhi, hands over the tablets, telling them to take them straight away. But instead of falling into a deep sleep, 20 of his would-be victims, there were nearly 40, 20 of his would-be victims began vomiting and collapsing. A pandemonium broke out and the police are called. It's the first time that the police have really been close to Charles Sobhraj. And he's handed to the police along with Barbara Smith and Mary Ellen Ether and indeed Marie-André Leclerc. Hmm. And at that point, we have to wait and see what the second part of The Serpent is about.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. That was so interesting. So now we'll break for part two next week because it's already complicated enough just in terms of like where he's been and, you know, let alone all of the stuff that happens after that point.
Yes, and it is a good point to stop because it then becomes even more convoluted.
It's very, yeah, it's a really, yeah, I mean, wow. And I don't know if you want to talk. I was just so interested in his kind of motivation. I don't know if this is to be covered in the next episode.
I think we'll cover it in the next episode.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay, well, to be discussed, TBD. well, thank you very much. That was part one of The Serpent. Yeah, and check it out on iPlayer if you're in the UK and hopefully on, you know, Netflix.
And it will be
soon.
With you on Netflix.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts and comments on the show. A couple of you have already messaged me to say you really loved it. And a lot of my contemporaries, colleagues, peers have enjoyed it, which has been good.
Good.
Because my client, Stacey Martin, plays Charles Sobhraj's first wife, who is renamed because she is still alive.
She is indeed.
And there was a lot of worry about that before they made the show and released it.
Yep.
But look out for Stacey too. Great, thanks, Dad.
Pleasure. So what are you doing this week, darling? Coming up?
I mean, the same as last week.
Oh.
I work from home. I have my schedule. I get up, I do my yoga, get dressed, I take Betsy for a walk. I start my day, have a meeting at 10 every day. And I have a meeting with my assistant, and then I work all day and have a second meeting with my assistant. Then I continue to work and have a third meeting with my assistant. Then I eat dinner, and then I go to bed.
Whew.
And it just goes like that.
Mine's pretty much the same.
On repeat.
I get up. I make a little breakfast. I open up my laptop. I start working on whatever needs to be worked on. There's always correspondence. I've got books flooding in again. There's a deluge of books always in my front door because I'm a reviewer for the Daily Mail. I look at them. I try and decide what to do next. I answer the emails that there are. I make myself some lunch properly because I prefer to have lunch rather than dinner because I'm not so keen on eating very much at night. And I have my lunch. I always watch the news. Then if there's a government press conference, I'll watch that at 5. And then I'll watch whatever it is I'm currently looking at, whether it's the Night Stalker, whether it's...
Call my agent.
Yeah, call my agent, whether it's whatever. Just... And that's the way the day goes. And the next day, it goes about exactly the same. However, one day, no doubt, we'll be able to say
things again.
More exciting things again.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Thank you very much to all the people who help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, Audio Boom, for hosting us. My brother, Dan, who did the music. My friend, George, who did the caricature. Our caricature. Jeffrey for doing all the hard work, and to you the listeners, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We do, both Molly and I, appreciate it enormously. And as the serpent underlines, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.